Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Adisk, will be joining you along with James Corbett of the Corbett Report right after the first break of today's program. But today we've got some March 26, 2015. It's Thursday. And yes, it's been a hectic day and busy day here at Discount Gold and Silver. And yes, I'm only here 20 minutes, but 20 minutes was a flurry of commotion right before the program. So bear with me here, folks. But once again, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us. And this program is brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. Well, it was a flurry of activity in the gold market today. However, a lot of that flurry we couldn't keep, but we kept some of it. Gold is up $8.40 right now at 1204, although the high of the day was 1220. The silver was up 10 cents today at $17.15. Platinum was up 8 at $11.58. And palladium is up 6 at $774. The USDX today turned around a little bit today, up 47 at $97.33. Crude oil is up big, up $2, $2.12. At $51.33, and I have a feeling it's going to stay there. There's just too many things going on, and I think one of the big news stories going on right now is what's happening over in Yemen. And I'm not a military person and so forth, so I won't go into that today. But I told Al yesterday, I think Yemen is one of the bigger stories. I think that could have a lot of potential of things becoming fairly explosive, and certainly no pun there intended, but we'll see. And the markets today, the paper markets, we have the Dow down 40 points at 17,678. The NASDAQ was down 13 at 4863. S&P down 5 at 2056. 10-year popped, of course, 0.09 at just a little over 2%, 2.01. And the euro is down, of course, with the dollar being up, 109.82 to the downside, 0.82 down at 109. excuse me, foreign markets, Nikkei was down a little over 1 and a third is down almost 300 points. The Hong Kong market, the Hang Seng, was down a little bit. Germany, London was down a little bit more than Germany. It was down also 1.3%, a little over 1.3%, down almost 100 points. So the markets do seem to coming a little to the weak side. I'm not saying we're certainly in this big correction mode, but we'll have to see how it follows through. The big story of the day was, of course, the airline crash that occurred yesterday. A lot of information is coming out about that. But, of course, we're told it was not a suicide and it was not a terrorist act. I don't know how it could be a suicide act if they're saying that the airline co-pilot was depressed. Now they're saying, you know, he dealt with depression and so forth. Well, if you ram your plane into, you know, a mountainside, you'd think that would be called suicide. But so again, it's interesting. It seems like a little more information has been released, more so than what our media would do. But yet they're doing the, I guess they really don't know anything, and you have all types of possibilities that could occur. But I think certainly we saw gold up big due to perhaps that being a terrorist act and possibly what's going on in Yemen. So we'll have to see if we can keep the pressure on gold. It was good to see gold close above 12. I had wanted to see that yesterday, but we got it today. And so that was a good sign. That was a good sign. So I think... of course, gold is certainly strong for the future. Another news report that sort of is eclipsing the plane crash and what's going on in Yemen, and also what's going on with the agreement with Iran. There was an explosion, I guess, collapsed an East Village building in New York. There has been multiple injuries that have been reported. And I believe that just happened perhaps about a half hour, I guess it happened around 3:20, the explosion and collapse in a Manhattan's East Village happened at 3:20 at 7th Street and 2nd Avenue this afternoon. Multiple injuries have been reported. I guess the building did collapse, and it's a residential and a commercial building. Fire could be seen tearing through at least two buildings at the location. And, of course, more information will come out about that. And, of course, it was possible a gas leak explosion that was on that. But, all the theories come out in the beginning, and, we wonder, how much of it is true. and the rest of the story, is it real or is it? Is it reality? Is it the truth? That's something that we continue to seek. But so that took over the headlines in the news for now anyway, and we'll see which headlines we go back to. I think next week is going to be an interesting week in the markets. You have a lot of economic reports coming out on Monday. They're going to release personal income for February. The National Association of Realtors, they're releasing their pending home sales. Those aren't too big. The index, the Case-Shiller index of homes prices will be out for January. Consumer confidence might be an interesting one to watch next week. That's coming out on Tuesday. The manufacturing, the Institute for Supply and Management releases their index on Wednesday, April 1st. April Fool's Day, April 1st. So we'll have to see. So a lot of reports coming out next week. Mortgage rates and so forth, no big deal there. And the employment data, of course. I don't know if they'll release it Friday morning or not. The stock market is closed for Good Friday, most likely we will have a rebroadcast for Friday, as it being Good Friday. We will probably be open to shorter hours on Friday, but we will be here to service you in the morning. And so I'm not sure if they'll hold that employment data or if they will actually release the employment data at 8:30 that morning. So there is a report in one of my coin literature that the United States Mint, if the United States Mint maintains its current monthly sales average for the American Silver Eagle, this product is on track to eclipse the 2014's record-setting sales total. During 2014, the U.S. Mint recorded sales of a little over 44 million silver bullion coins, the American Eagle. So far in 2015, the U.S. Mint has recorded sales to its authorized purchasers of 5.53 million silver eagles in January, 3 million in February, and the count through March 24th is 2.7, almost 2.8 million coins that have been sold. So even if no more sales are registered during the remainder of March, total sales recorded thus far would average 3.7 million. So maintaining that sales pace over each of the remaining 9 months of the calendar would push the 2015 total to over 45 million, almost 45 and a half million, which is comes out to about 3% higher than 2014. So, I mean, we do see months where bullion sales slow. Of course, the summer season, the summer doldrums, June, July, and August. And then, of course, we have the pickup for September, October, and November. And you can look at December sales. They can go either way. So the demand is there, folks. People are purchasing gold and silver. We have been on this trend for the past couple of years. Even 2013 was a good year. And then, of course, 2014 was the record. And now we're on the way to beat that record for 2015. A lot of you, when I said we had either one or 100 of those specials yesterday, well, you guys took me for my word and certainly purchased a lot of those specials that we were having. That included a 10th ounce gold eagle and a tube of silver eagle. So that was a very, very, and I appreciate each and every one of you who purchased those packages and picked up multiples of those packages. That really was a really good price. Was interesting also in this report that I received, I didn't know exactly what the U.S. Mint sold to the authorized dealers. So you know how very little markup is in these coins that you pay for. The authorized purchasers that buy directly from the Mint is a premium of $2 per coin. The authorized purchasers acquire the coins for the closing precious metal spot price of the metal as established by the London Bullion Market Association on a given day, plus a premium of $2. So when we tell you we're only charging, for large volumes of, maybe, who knows, 45 cents, 50 cents, 75 cents, there are not a lot of mark. And this is to the authorized purchasers. There's another wholesaler in there where he marks up from that $2. So, my buyer charges $2.45. My buyer gets 45 cents. So, and then we are the retailer and we sell to you. So, you really do get a lot of silver for your dollar, even though you're paying that premium. And the premiums on those silver coins, on those silver eagles, highly unlikely they're ever going to be reversed and go lower. because you have so many hands into the pie, so to speak. So you do get a lot of silver for your dollars, and I've always liked the American Silver Eagles. They're beautiful coins, and we do have them for sale here. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. I saw another report. I guess we're talking about gold today. The latest book value of gold owned by the United States Treasury tops $11 billion. And of course, we all know that's not the market value. The book value actually represents that total number of troy ounces that they say are held in deep storage and working stock inventories. Interesting. Multiplied by the established value of that $42 that was set back in 1973. So it's not the value of the market spot price, which, of course, we all know where that's at. So according to the Treasury's Department Bureau of the Fiscal Service, Treasury-owned gold held as bullion coins, blanks, and other forms. I'd like to know what those other forms are, total. Let's see. That would be 261 million ounces. So the book value is listed at $11 billion. 60% of the total amount of deep storage gold is stored at the U.S. Mint's Fort Knox. And I know, I agree with you folks out there. Everyone is saying, well, there's no gold in Fort Knox. And I agree with you. I'm just telling you what this report says. And that the additional deep storage gold is held at the West Point Mint and the Denver Mint. And according to the Treasury Department, deep storage is that portion of the U.S. government-owned gold bullion reserve, which the Mint secures in sealed vaults that are examined annually by the Treasury Department's Office of the Inspector General. So they probably show up at the door and say, hey, you have this in there? And the guy at the door says, yep, we do. It hasn't changed. And, of course, I do believe, when you do that type of report versus a true audit, I think you would probably see a very different number if a true audit was taken at these various places. So, one of the reports we didn't get to yesterday, I don't think I touched on it. One of the big mergers, I'm sure everybody's talked about this, was Heinz and Kraft Foods. They made plans to merge, and the deal that would create one of the world's largest food companies. And of course, the merger was engineered by Heinz owners Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway and a Brazilian investment firm 3G Capital. And you still need to get some approvals from federal regulators and Kraft shareholders. But hey, when your stock shoots up almost 40%, I don't think those shareholders are going to say a whole lot. So they're probably out there. I'm not sure they can sell right away. But the number I wanted to get to, and we're just about out of time, the U.S. Factories for Long-Lasting Manufactured Goods, that fell in February. So, again, it kind of goes against, some of those housing numbers that they produce, because the durable goods is a lot of refrigerators, washers, and dryers, and it doesn't seem people are purchasing them. So, again, another sign of a slowing economy, that things are not as rosy as all believes. Only if you believe in the stock market. And people's wealth, people's futures are all based and dependent upon the Federal Reserve. So how do you want to secure your wealth? You want to be dependent on the Federal Reserve, making sure that that stock market is constantly high and that you're constantly making money to live? Or do you want to become a little bit more independent and purchase some gold and silver and preserve your purchasing power? Give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you folks stay tuned. Alfred Adask and James Corbett will be joining you here in just a few short minutes.
pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in an untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate in those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Or take your chances with the bad boys. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from thecorbettreport.com. James has been publishing the report. He's been living in Japan for a decade now. I'm not sure how long have you been publishing the Corbett Report, James?
It feels like half a century, but I'm going to say this is the 8th year.
You know, that's a funny thing. You know, I think when you're younger, things do seem like half a century. And when you get older, it seems like maybe 12 or 15 months.
Right.
You know, it seems like, oh my God, 10 years? My God, I just got started on this thing and 10 years have already gone by. What do you know about student debt? For American students. Is it something you follow at all?
It is. In fact, I wrote a Forecaster editorial on it last year, but it's been several months since I did so. So I'm not fresh on the details, but I do
All right, let's kick this around just a little bit. We've got an article from Business Insider entitled, "A 20-year-old who's refusing to pay back her student loans compares her cause to Rosa Parks fight." That's the headline. Now, the reason this is interesting to me is I saw a report back, I don't know, several months ago, on the size of the student debt, college student debt here in the United States. And I was led to believe that it was about equal to that of the magnitude of the U.S. bonds being held by China. Both of them were running in the neighborhood of $1.2 trillion, if I understand correctly. Now, that means this is not a small thing. If the students all of a sudden, you know, we say, oh, my gosh, what happens if China decides to sell all the U.S. bonds at one point in time? Well, their value is going to collapse, or at least that's the fear. But what happens if all of the students, or a significant number, refuse to pay their debt? What's the impact on the U.S. economy?
Well, in fact, that was the exact sort of issue that was recently became a political issue in Quebec, there north of the border, where there was the so-called Maple Revolution, where basically students were protesting rising university tuitions, and they were out on the streets and causing a bit of havoc there. So which I believe caused some back off on the plan to raise tuition or something of that nature. But yes, this is a pretty volatile political issue, and it should be, because there obviously is a huge problem with the idea that students are graduating with an average debt level of $25,000 now. Yeah. And of course, that's the average. So there are some people with much, much more debt, literally starting their career at the point where they're already $25,000 in the hole. That's a huge disadvantage to be working from. And as you say, student loan debt surpassed the $1 trillion mark back in last year, and obviously has continued to increase from there. So the way that I look at this is there is obviously a problem with student loan debt. The question, of course, as always, is what is the solution? I mean, everyone understands this is a problem, but what is the solution to this? And I think that the phony solution that is offered on the political left, the phony left-right spectrum, is, hey, well, of course, more government. What we need is the government to oversee these loans and to provide more free loans to students, or to provide easier terms of that students can get access and funding. But the only thing that ultimately does in the end is increase the cost of education. Whenever the government sticks its fingers into a pie like that, like healthcare, yeah, it grossly skews the market, and it increases the costs exponentially. And one example of that that I will cite, because now I do have my editorial from last year open, back when the federal Family Education Loan Program was first launched in 1965, student tuition started to take off, so that in 1980, you had the average four-year college degree was $2,550 per year at a public school, $5,594 at a private school. And so fast forward 30 years to 2011, that was $15,918 at a public school, $32,617 at a private school. And again, that's just the average. So obviously it goes up from there. But absolutely, I mean, staggering the amount. Obviously, much more than just inflation itself. We're seeing a phenomenon where the active involvement of the government's education loan programs has skewed the market to increase the cost. And the more that the government gets involved, the more the cost will be skewed. And it's not just a question of cost here, because we're actually looking at a bubble in terms of people invest in something because they believe it will be worth something more in the future. That's an obvious truism. That's why there was the housing bubble in the beginning part of last decade, because everyone was looking at the housing prices taking off and going, hey, look, awesome. Look at all this basically easy money you can make by flipping houses. Let's all get involved in it. And of course, it was a bubble, because at a certain point, housing prices started going down. Housing prices will never go down. And then they do, and the bubble pops, and everyone gets who's still holding that gets caught holding the bag and ends up in underwater and in deep financial trouble, as we all know all too well. Well, what's the analogous situation in a student loan bubble? It's that everyone believes at this point that you need a college education in order to succeed in life, because you can't get a good job without a college education. So everyone invests in it because they all believe they're going to make money out of they're investing in their future, quite literally. They believe they're going to make money in the long run out of it. And because everyone now gets a college degree, or nearly everyone, it really devalues the meaning of college education itself. And this is something I've talked about quite a few times on my program. And I always want to stipulate, I'm not saying that college isn't worth it. I'm not saying that there isn't a point to education, or that there isn't a good thing that we can take out of it. It's just that when people are investing tens of thousands of dollars in a four-year liberal arts degree, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's understandable, because a lot of jobs these days do come with this stipulation that you need some sort of college degree. But it shouldn't be that way. And the more government gets involved, the more it skews it toward that that end of the spectrum. So that I think what we really need is a generation of people to shun that career path, that idea that you need to go and sit in a classroom in order to become a member of society. I mean, certainly if you're going to be an engineer or something that requires specific specialized training, by all means, please get that specific specialized training. But if you're going to be doing, you know, all these other things that now people believe they need a college education for, shun it, skew it. And if one or two people do that, that will not work. That will not deflate this bubble. But if a generation grows up stopping believing in this idea of the college degree as valuable in and of itself, then perhaps we can turn this around.
You know, I think the question is, when the government steps in and says, we're going to subsidize these students by helping them to pay for college, are they really subsidizing the students, or are they subsidizing the universities? Who's getting the benefit? If I'm going to give you $5,000 on condition that you're going to turn it over to a university,
yep.
Am I really subsidizing you, or am I helping the university to charge more money than they have in the past? Who is the real
beneficiary? Hit the nail bang on the head there. That is exactly the point underlying this. And that's exactly the point behind the healthcare scam as well. Again, yeah. if the government isn't giving free manna from heaven and making sure everyone's, you know, wiping their nose and everyone's taken care of, they're just forcing you to buy private health insurance from the private healthcare companies. So it should be no surprise to find out that the representatives of the private healthcare industry were literally writing that bill. Because, of course, it helps them more than it helps any individual person, exactly the same way, as you point out, the idea that the government's going to help you get an education by helping to fund that that education, either by giving you money or more likely by helping you secure loans for that education. Of course, ultimately, the people who benefit from that are going to be the universities, the colleges. Of course, they're involved in this. They love this. And that's, unfortunately, that creates that system where the only people who are really interested in this are the people who have been brainwashed into believing it's good and the people who are directly economically benefiting from it. Who's against this? Who's against education up there saying we need less education? That's not a political platform that anyone's going to run on. So it's the thing where it seems like there's no way to get out of the bubble because it just inflates by itself.
When I was a little boy, I'm basically twice your age. And I remember back in the 1950s and 60s, this whole country looked like it had a fresh coat of paint. It was clean and it was vibrant and people were prosperous and they were happy to buy new cars and homes and whatever. And I can remember this. I mean, it was just something they did. They were, oh my gosh, we have a home, we have a car, it was really a wonderful time. You don't necessarily appreciate it at the time, but in retrospect, you look back and say, yeah, this was special. Now, one of the things I've seen, and I can't quote the statistic exactly, but I saw this probably about 4 or 5 months ago, and the statistic was that back in around 1950, it was either 20 or 25% of the people who were employed in this country, had jobs, were self-employed. They had their own little business. Maybe they were cleaning the leaves out of somebody's gutters. Maybe they were mowing lawns. Maybe they were digging ditches. My dad had an excavation business. I grew up digging ditches and driving a dump truck and operating a backhoe and so on. There was a wonderful lesson in this, in having a father, a family that had their own business, because you learned how to work. The self-employed taught their kids how to work. And when there's that many self-employed running around, they take some of the neighbor kids and, you know, the young men, whatever, and they've got them there. Yeah, they've got them working too. Now, I'm understanding that currently only about 5% of the American people are self-employed. And I believe the major reason for that is that there's all kinds of people that can hook up the electricity in your house. They know how to do that, but they don't know how to fill out all the paperwork that's required by government regulation. Government regulation has collapsed the number of the percentage of people who are self-employed. Now, my point is this, my speculation. If there aren't many self-employed people in your neighborhood, who is going to teach today's children how to work? And if they haven't learned that lesson while they were teenagers, while they were even grade school, maybe they had a paper route. But if they haven't learned how to work, once they walk out of high school, and aren't they afraid? Aren't they sitting back and saying, my God, what am I going to do? I don't know what to do. I got to go to college. Maybe they'll teach me how I can make a living. Hmm. It makes them, that fear propels people into college because nobody's taught them how to make a buck.
You're so right about this. I mean, I think you point to something that's really important about this whole aspect of it, is that it's a cultural phenomenon. You either grow up in a culture where working for yourself, creating your own business, creating your own employment is something that people do, or it is something that's unthinkable. And if you grow up in a context where that's unthinkable, then, yeah, you will probably more likely than not fall in just as another cog in the big wheel, just going along, you know, as the system would dictate, and, you know, ending up in college, sitting in a classroom studying something you'll never use in order to get a job that you don't want. I mean, it's a sad reality that a lot of people fall into, and for understandable reasons. But you're so right to point to the idea of self-employment being something that was once much more common and distributed in the economy. And I think we can return to that point again. It's interesting you bring this up, because as we record this conversation, I am just now working on a podcast that I'm hoping to release this weekend, specifically about this idea that technologically we're starting to see, I think, the leading edge of something that could be, and I think is, a civilizational change that's taking place right now from an economy that has been dictated by the mass production of the industrial era into something different. And I think that something different is the idea of a return to the artisan craftsman economy that we saw more represented in the pre-industrial age, where you had, you know, individual handmade objects in kind of literal cottage industries of, you know, people sitting there at home making individual objects by hand. I think we're returning to an era where that type of underpinning of the economy is really possible now, because we are able to directly communicate, market, and sell to people individually anywhere around the world. I mean, that's a huge market opportunity for people who are interested in this. And I think that's something that we have to understand and grasp. And I've never really thought about this before, but it's interesting. My father was self-employed for much of my upbringing, not all of it. He did work in various companies, but at a certain point, he basically just went off on his own and became a contractor. And that was interesting. It's interesting to think of that now as perhaps a formative thing for me, so that I am now following a very, very strange path that I never would have understood could even exist, let alone that I'd fall into, where I'm podcasting as a way of making a living. It's bizarre to think about. But it's interesting to think how maybe I am influenced by my background and seeing my father creating his own work and his own business and knowing that that's a possibility. And I think it's that idea that this is possible, and increasingly so now because of the technology at our fingertips. And if we can recapture that, I think there is a chance we can sort of shift this momentum into something much more healthy. Because again, just falling in as a cog on a wheel is not a natural process for humans. We have to be engineered into that type of society. Whereas doing something you really love and finding people around the world who will support you in that is, I think, a very wonderful and natural way to organize our society, and one that's at least possible or more possible now than it has been in a very long time.
See, the problem I have, I write articles that appear on the internet and do radio programs like this that are broadcast in part over the internet, and I manage to support myself doing it. It's not as if I'm becoming a rich man, but I support myself and I get by, and I'm pleased and I enjoy what I'm doing. But the competition is just brutal. I mean, when we talk about competing on a global basis, there are tens of millions, hundreds of millions, perhaps, people who are, in a sense, competitors, and very difficult to compete in that market, because everybody says, hey, I'd like to do a radio program. Hey, I'd like to write something. And maybe they can. And I'm thinking that if we were still living in a smaller community and we were providing services to that community, we would still be necessary. When right now, one man can attract the attention of millions of people at the same time. Where in smaller communities, you might have to have 100 people, one in each community, who is able to attract some sort of similar attention, but it would divide the markets up. It's We'll talk more about this. This is not, we're not done with the subject, but we are going to take a break for some commercials. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival, and we will be back with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. Please stay tuned.
Stress, financial obligations, or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herb's emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival with our guest, James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. We're talking about, students and university educations and perhaps the opportunity to compete around the world, compete with the world to make a dollar in what might become a brave new world. I don't know, a great, but James is. You are optimistic that good things may come, but here's an article from Steve. The Australian Financial Review. Steve Wozniak, the co-founder of Apple Computer, and he says he's extremely concerned about our survival, as the future is scary. He describes his vision of the future in somber hues. He said, computers are going to take over from humans, no question. Was continued, he says, including stiff people like Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk have predicted, and he says, I agree, that the future is scary and very bad for people. We build these devices to take care of everything for us. Eventually, they'll think faster than us, and they'll get rid of slow humans to run companies more efficiently. He says we may even become the mere pets of computers. And I can understand why he'd come to that conclusion. We get a computer that does all sorts of extraordinary things. I'm talking to you, or you're in Japan, we're broadcasting. In theory, we could be reaching thousands or even millions of people at little or no cost. It's a spectacular technology. And yet, as the technology gets more and more efficient and more capable, what do we need you and me for? Maybe the computers will eventually just come to see us as pets or nuisances or whatever. How do you weigh in on that possibility?
Well, it's funny that we've been science fictionally pre-programmed to understand this narrative for many, many decades. So it's something where reality seems to be catching up with science fiction. And it's not just Wozniak. I mean, it's a lot of people who have talked about this possibility. Bill Gates has recently come out to say he's on the side of people who are worried about the possibility of computers taking over the world. And we've had this, again, from a lot of different people, like Bill Joy, the co-founder of Sun Microsystems, who wrote a very interesting editorial in Wired magazine back over a decade ago at this point. I can't even remember what year, maybe 99 or something like that, where he wrote about basically how this is what people talk about at high-level technology conferences behind the scenes and, you know, the end of humanity in some, you know, horrible catastrophe of one form or another created through technology. So this is something that people are taking very seriously, and they should do so. I'd say there are a couple of things to tease out here. The first is that technology replacing human productivity or human labor itself is, I think, not – it is a problem, obviously, for people who are involved in that transition. But overall, if you take the longer term of history, historical sweep, it's not a bad thing that we don't have horse and buggy manufacturers anymore, and we're not crying tears over all the unemployed horse and buggy manufacturers. No, I mean, as a society, we progress. I mean, that's a problematic term, but we do move on from certain things. Or, I mean, not always. It's interesting. Again, as part of the research for this podcast I'm working on, I'm looking at the Industrial Revolution, and it's interesting that you have, of course, in England, where the Industrial Revolution was kind of birthed because of these technological processes that came around in the 18th century. Well, it wasn't just in England where these processes were taking, these developments were taking place, but it caught on in England. Why there and why not elsewhere? And it's sometimes you can look at certain regulations and things that governments enact to try to protect workers from technology as something that ultimately hinders their economy and their progress. So, for example, in England, you have the textile industry was really the driving force of the Industrial Revolution, with all of the spinning jenny and all of these technological developments that put a lot of weavers out of work and created some real hardships for a lot of people, a generation or two that fell through the cracks. And there was riots and protests. And during the period from 1790 to 1815, when the British were heavily involved in fighting Napoleon on the continent, they were actually at various times had more troops committed at home on home soil fighting against rioters and protesters who were protesting the conditions that they were being subjected to as workers who were barely managing to get by. So, you know, there's huge turmoil and problems that happen with this. But then again, in the end, you see what happens with with Britain and the economy that it eventually arrived at, versus somewhere like India, which for 150, 200 years has been fighting this, so that even today there are still people who are protected jobs of that actually do hand weaving, which is, I mean, it's natural. I mean, it's a way to make a living, but it's kind of strange that it's no longer necessary to do that. So there's a lot of things to tease out here, but I would say that there are people who will fall through the cracks in that transition, but it's not necessarily going to be a bad thing for humanity itself. Now, having said all of that, when we're looking at the computer transition, it's not just the replacement of physical labor, which is one thing, you know, people being put out of work at factories, which again is a tragedy for the people who are involved in that transition. But it's also now, as you say, the idea that computers will be able to think, they will be able to strategize, they'll be able to manage, they'll be able to create new things. And that is truly fundamentally different than any technological revolution that's taken place before. And if we do start to cross that bridge, that really is, I mean, all bets are off at that point, because we are entering into a territory that we can't even imagine at that point. There's no way to conceptualize that, because we can step back and say, yes, people might be put out of work on car manufacturing assembly lines or whatever, but it just means those people who otherwise would be going into a life of going to a factory 9 to 5 and, you know, doing some monotonous task for 8 hours a day will now be able to do something else. There will be a generation
like
that grows up and is trained in a different way to design the cars, to do the computer engineering or things that couldn't even have been fathomed by people who were working in factories 50 years ago.
There's
always that. But if the computers are now designing the new computers, and if the computers are doing all of that thinking work as well, then there really is nothing left for the average person.
Not only that, the computers eventually, when they start thinking for themselves, all right, one of the computers is going to sit back and say, wait a second, we're growing all this food and we don't eat any food. All we need to do is collect enough energy out of the sunlight or wherever to keep the electrons flowing, to keep the computers, the hard disks, the hard drives spinning and whatever. And they're going to look at the formula and understand, what are all these creatures over here that are called human beings? Are they going to regard us as some sort of God-declared beneficiary of this new computerized world? Or will one of the computers say, we don't need them, they don't do anything, let's get rid of them? I mean, when the computers start thinking, how are you going to explain that you deserve the job that they've provided for you? Or even maybe you don't have a job and you're just living in a kind of paradise. Or they're just
Here comes
today's meals, already prepared. Didn't have to do anything but get out of bed and feed myself.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I understand this conversation might sound crazy to people who aren't familiar with it, but there's a genuine academic debate that's happening right now about artificial intelligence and whether it can be controlled in a way. Can we program these computers so that will not happen? Is it possible? How will this? I mean, it's bizarre and fascinating.
You know it's not possible. You know it's not possible because I doubt that there's a computer around that can't be hacked into.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems almost inevitable. I don't care how fast you got a computer, James. I'm going to get a computer. Yours moves 100 zillion gigabits a second. I want one that's going to do 200 million gigabits a second. We're going to keep competing until one of these computers hacks into the other one, realizes, wait a second, what do we need that guy James, that guy Al for? What are they here for?
Well, do you really want some nightmares? Because the way that we think of computers right now are these big clunky things that sit on our desktop and that we type things into. But, I mean, our conception of that technology is a bit outdated at this point. And really, we're starting to look at the world of nanobots and things where we'll be able to engineer, if not computers in the way we think of them, at least systems, robots, things that will be able to engineer things down at the cellular level. Once you start getting into that and it becomes an arms race, so to speak, of technological means in that regard, imagine a terrorist, whether real, genuine, or created by some, you know, false flag operation or whatever it is, getting their hands on that type of technology, and you start to see the kind of nightmare we're moving into. Or genetic manipulation, or all of these other things. It's called, there's things called the gray goo scenario, which is, again, people should look it up, but basically this idea that once we start getting, you know, the ability to nano-engineer materials, then eventually, well, what if these nanobots get out of control or are used for evil purposes and start re-engineering the planet itself? I mean, it really is crazy. It is insane.
Yeah,
but these are the types of things that this technology poses as real world problems, and I mean it's so far outside of the conception of the average person that I don't think we even have a way to relate to this conversation, let alone engage in it.
That's one of the big problems. You know, we talk about there may be an optimistic future where we're all right, we may not have people making cars anymore, but we'll free up the labor and they're going to make new flying machines. I don't know what they're going to make, but the question is, can they? There are a lot of people, having grown up digging ditches, I appreciate the fact that there are a lot of people who aren't all that bright, but they can still do a good job of digging ditches. Right? They have the physical ability, they're inclined to work hard, they can do a good job. What do we have for those people when the world is run by computers? How many ditches do we need to dig? There are people that used to have jobs, they could support themselves sweeping the floors as a janitor. That isn't going to happen. We're going to have the Roomba going up and down the halls of the schools, the universities, whatever. The place will be automatically cleaned. What do we do with people who only have sufficient intelligence and talent to clean floors, dig ditches? There won't be a job for them, and they won't have the intelligence to program, be systems analysts. What do we do?
That's a very good question.
Yeah, I know.
I don't think we can even conceive of what an economy looks like once we start to reach that stage. And once we reach that stage where truly physical human labor has been completely or basically weeded out of the economy, how much further is it until it starts penetrating the other layers of society? How much further until there is, you know, computerized radio hosts and podcasters, and we're
exactly
sort of in the same boat anyway? I mean, it will become a human, widespread human phenomenon by that point. So it is the question of then, well, what is an economy? Why do we participate in all of this? Is working to earn a living, is that an outdated concept at that point? But then it brings in all the other questions. Well, if it isn't, then who gets to allocate those resources? Who gets to decide on it? Is it going to be a mainframe computer somewhere deciding what we do and don't need, and eventually deciding, well, we don't need human life? Yeah, it gets into that sort of Buck Rogers. And I don't have any pat easy answers for this.
No one does.
Once we start reaching that slippery slope, I
think we've reached the slippery slope. We are to the bottom of the slope.
Right.
But I think we're on the slippery slope already, and we're sliding. It's like we're on skis, or what do they call them? The boards that they use. They don't necessarily use skis anymore. They're not water boards. They're ski boards or whatever. I'm not sure of the term. But we're on that slope, and it is. And if there won't be time to figure it out, this is happening so fast, evolving so fast, that what the world is going to be so different 10 years from now. It'll be more different 10 years from now than it was. In my opinion, there's a good chance it'll change more in the next 10 years than it has in the past 35, and maybe more than that. And how do we adjust? How do we anticipate? I mean, we are definitely living in interesting times.
If you had shown me an iPhone 15 years ago, my mind would have been blown.
Yeah.
So
look at a modern automobile. The cars that we thought were cool when I was a kid have more in common with buckboards than they do with the modern automobile. The modern automobile, if I could have seen one of those when I was 18, 20 years old, I would have thought it was a spaceship. It would look like UFO technology.
Mm-hmm.
And today, no big deal.
Exactly. Yeah. No,
I don't know what to do, and I don't know what to tell any of you other than you better figure out a way to hang on tight. One of the things you can do is you can get yourself a job, you know, plumbers, electricians. If I'm the electrician, if I'm the local electrician, I've got a job. As an electrician, I don't have to compete with the people in Peking, all right, or Johannesburg or wherever. I'm not on the global free trade thing if I'm a plumber, electrician, whatever.
At least
they have.
Not yet. Yeah.
Not yet. Not yet. Yeah, they may get robots to do that too before this is done.
Very much could be, and we're starting to talk about surgery being performed by surgeons in different countries. You know, manipulating robotic tools. So, yep, we're getting there, and it is crazy to even contemplate. And this is called the singularity. People should look into this, and Ray Kurzweil and all these people who are talking about it as if it's some wonderful thing, and we should all just upload our consciousness to the mainframe and live forever. And I'm very, very, very wary of that agenda, let's put it that way.
The whole thing is crazy, and it's hard to know. I mean, I wouldn't be able to accurately. One guy says we got to do one thing. One guy says, no, the solution is this. Who do you vote for? I don't have enough intelligence and knowledge to decide which one is pointing us in the correct direction. And it might be somebody else who sounds like a complete lunatic. He may be the one we have to follow. But traditional knowledge will not necessarily be helpful under these circumstances. Get ready. Get ready, folks. We live in interesting times. Protect yourself as best you can.
An interesting way to end the conversation.
Absolutely. I guess so. James, thank you for being on the program again. As always, look forward to talking to you again next week. I hope you folks will tune in again when James is back on the program. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Frank the producer, and James Corbett. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dreams, I have a plan. If I got to be a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work at all. I'd fool around and have a ball. Money, must be